Hey, Justers, welcome to another installment of the Just Podcast. This is Barry Robertson here with Vicky Lee, and today we want to talk to you about scepticism. Questioning is at the very heart of the scientific method, and so as scientists and science enthusiasts, we're all familiar with scepticism in some way, shape, or form. Questioning what we're presented with and finding the truth behind things makes the scientist and the science better.
But what happens when the very field of science your research centres around is brought into question? We spoke with Dr. Caroline Watt, founding member of the Kessler's Parapsychology Unit and researcher in parapsychology at the University of Edinburgh, to find out what role scepticism plays in her research and how her field is affected by the ever-present scrutiny of the outside world.
And parapsychology has benefited quite a lot. I mean, there's a good example from the Ganfelt literature, which is a method that's used to test for extrasensory perception. And it's a mild altered state of consciousness. It's a method it's thought to be conducive to psychic abilities. So parapsychologists have used this for decades in their ESP tests. And there was a very good exchange between Charles Onaton in the 1970s and Ray Hyman. In fact, 70s and 80s. Ray Hyman's a well-known and well-informed skeptic of parapsychology. I presume you've heard of him.
Yes.
Maybe not. Maybe not. I mean, he's a psychologist, but also with expertise in magic and cold reading. Runs workshops on how to do cold reading, fake mediumship abilities, and a lot of skeptics. You know, because it's quite complicated. You know, doing good research in parapsychology is complicated. A lot of skeptics kind of. Somewhat armchair skeptics, they don't really get involved, but Ray Hyman really put a lot of time and effort into familiarizing himself with the Ganfelt literature. And he did a meta-analysis of the literature, a number of studies, arguing that there was a significant effect there, but he thought that there were possible artifacts within the experiments that explained the effect. And then Charles Onaton came back, and the two came back and forth a little bit, Charles Onaton being a proponent, and he, you know, invented the Ganfelt. And they could have argued and kind of got rather aggressive about it, but they decided in the end, they met at a conference, and they decided they actually agreed on quite a lot. So they published a joint communique, which basically was like a joint paper where they set out what they agreed upon, on this database, which they'd been arguing about, and what recommendations they had to move the field forward in terms of methodological improvements. And then subsequent research took these recommendations into account. So it's a lovely example where a parapsychologist and a skeptic work together quite productively. But in order to do that, the skeptic has to really become intimately acquainted with the literature, and that does require quite a lot of effort. So not everybody is willing to do that.
A great example there of sceptics and proponents actually working together for the benefit of science itself. Implementing these changes and increasing the robustness of the research then further benefited parapsychology as it changed the way the wider scientific community treated it.
If you look at Randi, sort of archetypal ace sceptic, James Randi, who just recently announced his retirement from JREF, but not from scepticism, and he's been sceptical about paranormal claims for 73 years and been working to expose fake psychics and charlatans. He's an example, and PsyCorp and JREF are perhaps examples where, for a time they did target parapsychology and parapsychologists. And, the most famous example is Project Alpha, where Randi basically planted a couple of magicians into a parapsychology lab and they proceeded to pull the wool over the investigators' eyes. And they were faking PK effects, mind over matter effects, mostly. And they found ways of circumventing the precautions that the lab had imposed. And parapsychologists, some of them reacted rather defensively to that and thought it was an unethical thing to do. But many of them actually found that this had done a service to the field because it had identified a naivety and where there were weaknesses. And so I think it kind of was a bit of an eye-opener for the field, and parapsychologists tightened up after that and included magicians. For example, at Edinburgh, we had Richard Wiseman and Peter Lamont, who's still there, both with expertise in magic as well as psychology. So I think since those days, looking at the activities of PsyCorp and JREF, they're targeting much easier targets now, because I think parapsychology has actually tightened up its game. So they're looking at creationists and, you know, Sally Morgan type fake psychics, and not really worrying too much about parapsychologists. I think parapsychologists are trying quite hard to be scientific in their approach.
Once seen as an easy target, they now tend to leave the field alone as parapsychology has tightened its methods. If they're doing the science properly, where's the problem? This is further exemplified by the fact that Caroline's group exists within the psychology department instead of being a separate fringe group. Now, so far, we've only discussed how the application of proper skepticism has been advantageous for parapsychology, but that's only part of the story. In fact, because of the intense scrutiny of its skeptics, parapsychology has not only tightened up its own methods for research, but developed new methods of data analysis for the benefit of science as a whole. Dr. Wei explains.
But I think that there's also a lot of, there's examples, and Gansfeld, again, is one of them, where the challenge of trying to do well-controlled research in parapsychology and to evaluate is there any evidence for supposed psychic abilities sometimes pushes methodological advances that are useful to the mainstream as well as to parapsychologists. And the Gansfeld debate is an example of that, because it was a controversy that some of the Gansfeld experiments were coming up with positive, significant results, and others were chance, and there was a great debate over how do we interpret this. And there was a fairly new technique that statisticians were beginning to use called meta-analysis, which was a way of synthesizing research bodies of studies and doing a kind of quantitative review. And slightly, it's not totally objective, but it's more objective than the traditional form of literature review. And parapsychologists were quite quick to pick up on this method, quicker than most psychologists, and were doing meta-analyses and considering the statistical issues that go with meta-analysis, which is, you know, questions about power of the study and the effect size, and earlier than psychologists were. And Bob Rosenthal, who's a great methodologist in psychology, actually said that, you know, parapsychologists had done a service for science in general as well as for themselves by bringing this technique into sort of public awareness, because one of the leading psychology journals had begun to publish parapsychology meta-analyses. So sometimes the challenge of studying these controversial claims can have unintended consequences which are beneficial for science in general.
So on a global and local level, we can see the positive effects skepticism can have. Are there any negative effects? Dr. Watt's late colleague and mentor, Bob Morris, thought so. He was of the mind that there were advocates, those with a firm belief in something, say the paranormal, and counter-advocates, those who were staunchly opposed to the idea, and that neither was a good position to hold. To be a true skeptic, one has to be in between the two, with a view to find holes in the logic and research, but with an open mind that's able to be challenged.
Exactly. It's so important to be able to question the facts, but more so to have an open mind capable of change when presented with the right evidence from the right sources. And that brings me nicely to an earlier point we kind of glanced over a little bit quickly. Dr. Watt mentioned that in order for skepticism to work properly, the skeptic has to put in the effort and get acquainted with the research, and I'm a little bit torn on that. I definitely agree that before you apply scepticism to something, you need to have researched both points of view to be able to come to some sort of conclusion. But realistically, we can't all be experts in everything.
So that leads us to the question, how do you ensure that you've put enough research into something before being sceptical of it? And how do you choose your sources? The next part of the podcast will be an open discussion, and we'll be joined by Gabby Billen and Josh Marsh. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, guys. Yeah, no, I definitely enjoyed listening to you guys talk about the last bit. Yeah, that's definitely an interesting question of how you apply skepticism to fields that you are not necessarily knowledgeable in, right?
Yeah.
And I think one of the main points that I would have is the first thing you can do is to try and figure out what the majority of the experts believe. And I've kind of had this talk with people about sort of whether or not you should go with what the experts believe, because, you know, the experts can be wrong and et cetera, yeah, et cetera. And my response to that is that, yeah, the experts can be wrong. That happens. However, you don't really have a better method of finding things out than to go with what the experts believe, because the experts have always put more thought into it than you have.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of what that is. What do you guys think?
And then there's, yeah, I mean, that's definitely true. And a lot of the times, I mean, your only other option, and it's a shame that people do tend to go for it, is you go with an idea that's not come from an expert. And the example I'm thinking of just now is with the vaccinations, and where people have clearly went for someone who claimed to be an expert, but it was quite clearly debunked. But then, you know, they've not then reverted to the actual experts. It's an idea that's kind of taken hold and spread a wee bit.
That one's interesting because it's actually quite an extreme example of that, right? Because I think it's really just like one guy versus everybody.
Pretty much.
So I think that's actually a good example of not going with the majority of the experts when it's like a 99.999% type of thing.
Yeah, that's more of an example of believing in what you want to believe in rather than believing in research or what the general consensus of the experts have to say.
Yeah.
It's actually quite sad. I was looking through the news stories the other day, and I saw that there was this woman who had written a book for children on the advantages of having measles over getting vaccinated against measles. And so that's been something that's been a bit of an uproar in the news. But yeah.
I think vaccination in general is such a topic where everyone's involved. And yep. I mean, absolute majority of people don't have any knowledge. But it's sad that when one person who's just shouting the loudest, like the loudest of all, gets everyone's attention instead of those people who are a lot of them and having a proper knowledge of the thing. That is a sad thing. And also I think what James mentioned, that it's important that the research should be more recent, and you can't really trust the arguments from 1990 against the arguments from 2014.
Yeah.
Because it's always going to be the answers coming in 2014 for the questions in 1990.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's a good point. It's like if you're taking both sources, so if you want to find sources from both sides, which is a good idea in general, kind of obvious.
Yep.
I think one thing that people do oftentimes is they'll take sources, like you said, from like 1990, and then they'll take a source that's recent from 2014, and they'll find, like, obviously the 2014 source has answered everything from the 1990 source, or has tried to answer all of the arguments from the 1990 source. So you're not really getting a good representation of what, like, the current iteration of the proponents of the 1990 source, what their arguments are. So that's another issue I think that people have.
And it's very likely as well that the source from 2014 is going to mention the source from the 1990 beforehand if it's based on the same topic.
But another problem is, like, even if you do it properly and you say, okay, I'll take recent sources, you're still only taking one of each. For example, we'll say you take one of each, two of each, three of each. It still then looks like even if it's something that's not, it still makes it look like it's a 50-50 discussion, when, like with vaccinations or climate change, for example, where, you know, it's not 50-50. But by taking even amounts of sources, it kind of makes it feel like it is. And so I think we rely a lot on other experts having, so the thing you really need to do, and actually Caroline mentioned it, is meta-analysis. It's looking at how many sources there are for and how many sources there are against a certain point. And I think we rely a lot on media to do that for us, who have experts who are able to compile sources. And I just wonder how best to choose what media sources you go to for your information. Do you know what I mean?
If you're in America, not Fox News. Usually I think that, like, you know, depending on where you are, whether, like, what country you're in and stuff, there's usually you have access to something that's good, or everyone has access to the BBC, and everyone has access to National Public Radio in the States, which isn't as big over here, but if you haven't heard of it, now you have. National Public Radio tends to be pretty good, and I'm sure, you know, you can kind of Google reviews of different media organizations and just kind of do some research to figure out what's the most unbiased.
Yeah,
is a good idea. So don't only directly research the topic, but everyone should at some point research media outlets as well to see what's good. And then just sites like Snopes and such, where you can directly look up claims and see if they're true or not, you know, because you've had actual researchers go in, and that's what Snopes does. They have actual researchers go in and investigate whatever it is and debunk it if necessary. And they'll have on there saying, you know, false or not, just very easily.
Do you think that's kind of scaring people? Do you think when you say, And I mean, it's obvious to us, but do you think when you say you have to research the media outlets, so before you've done your research, you need to research the place you're going to go to do that research. So it makes it sound like it's, in the way I've just said, it makes it sound like it's scary and it's a lot of work. But I mean,
no, I think everyone in this digital age, everyone should be knowledgeable enough to know which source to trust. Let's say everyone knows that BBC is the trustworthy source. Fairly comparing to some other websites. So I think you sort of, let's say I'm doing research in art, which is absolutely different kind of thing to science, exact science and so on. And we are still using the same sort of resources. We still taught to sort of see where to find the information.
Yeah.
So I think we're just moving to that age where in university you're not learning facts, you're learning to research and where to find facts, how to, you know, sort the information, because information just, and knowledge and everything just coming at you. It's everywhere. It's accessible from the phone lying in your pocket. So it's not that you have to learn facts anymore. You have to learn how to research them, how to access them, how to find the trustworthy one.
That is kind of an interesting point of that we're getting into an age that's more the skill of finding facts than the actual facts themselves. But yeah, and I think another point that I would add on to that is that you wouldn't necessarily need to do that research into where you should get your sources every single time you research something. That's more of just, you need to sit down one day and have a session with Google or something where you figure out, if you don't already know, and I think most of us do, so I think this is kind of academic, but at some point, you know, you should have sat down and looked through news sources and figured out which ones are good and which ones are bad. Yeah. Have conversations with people that you know are academic or knowledgeable. If you have professors, you could talk to them about it. Yeah. But you should know what generally reputable sources are and which ones are generally not as reputable.
I think that's a good point, and I feel like as well, most people already know what sources are good. They, like, as we made the point earlier, like, haha, Fox News, we already know that it's not the most reliable of sources. It didn't take us a lot of time to figure that out. So when you're going for your research, you already know which ones to avoid. So you're more just filtering through which reliable source is the most reliable.
Yeah. But I mean, that's the thing, though. That's kind of the problem, is that not everybody does know that. And I think most of the people listening to this podcast probably don't have this problem. But if there weren't millions of people who read or listen to Fox News, then Fox News would not be Fox News.
Exactly. That's what I was going to say. Like, it's not like we can laugh in this. Like, it's easy for us to say things like, I'll bring it back to Britain, the Daily Mail or Fox News. It's easy for us to look at sources like that and laugh at them. But and actually, they're both a really good example, because Fox News, I don't know if, I'm assuming it's got a very, I know it's got a really high viewership. The Daily Mail's, or is it the Sun or the Daily Mail are the highest read newspaper in the UK, and it's like, that's, they're not being ignored. There's not, you know, people don't look at these things automatically and go, haha, dismiss. They pay attention. So
that's a good point, but I do feel like the conversation we're having right now is more about people who already want to challenge their opinions rather than people who are satisfied reading with one from one source.
Mm-hmm. But then, how do we go about, because that's good, and how do we go about those stopping or challenging people who, or getting people who don't want to challenge their methods or their views? How do we get them to start, you know?
That's an incredibly difficult question.
I don't think we're going to come up with the answer. I think
this brings us to another point, which is that, you know, what we're talking about is sort of a methodology for going about this, but the thing is that you will be wrong. You know, you can't always be right. And you know, the thing about being wrong is that it hurts. And when you are wrong in something that you strongly believe in, especially something you strongly believe in, or just something that you argue vehemently about, then that hurts. You feel stupid. People don't like being wrong, but part of being skeptical is that if you aren't occasionally letting yourself experience that pain and recognizing when you need to admit to yourself that you're wrong and need to experience that pain, then you're either omniscient or you're doing it wrong.
And being skeptical. And like previously mentioned in the podcast, like, the best position to be in is when you're happy to challenge research, but also happy to have a new opinion. And so the first step in being skeptical is to be satisfied with the idea that you might be wrong sometimes, and to be able to say, I don't know this right now, but I want to find out, and to go in to do more research there.
Has anybody had their mind changed in that kind of way before? Has anybody had their mind changed on something that they really strongly believed? Or not strongly believed, but, you know, has it ever happened to anyone?
Has it ever happened? Have we ever been
wrong?
Have you ever, yeah, have you ever, like, been, yeah? But so, not, like, wrong about what the weather was going to be like, so you went outside in the wrong jacket. I mean, have you been, like, have you had a point of view, an opinion on something specific, and then whatever's happened and you've had to go and maybe look a bit further into it and you've realised, oh, I was wrong?
Whereas in a more general example, when I'm like conducting research in my degree in psychology, I might say, well, this is my hypothesis and I, you know, seem to confirm it. However, there might be more variables and this is what I would suggest for further research. Like, that's how psychology is done, I'm sure, is true for other sciences. So I suppose that my example is that while I may seem to confirm what I already thought, I also know that manipulation of the independent variable may not be the only thing that is causing the change in the dependent variable.
I'm wrong a lot. I don't like to talk about how often I'm wrong, but I was actually recently listening to a debate about GMOs, so genetically modified organisms, and as if you're not aware, which I think most people are, it's usually like say wheat that's been modified to produce more wheat or be resistant. Yeah. So I was listening to a debate about GMOs, and what was interesting is when I was going into the debate, I was expecting the people who were against GMOs, and most people use GMOs as a good kind of cliche for skepticism, like, why would you be against GMOs? It's
I'm going to interrupt, because this we could witness this live here, because I have a rough opinion on GMOs, but I don't know enough about them, and I know that I need to read up more on them, because I had a specific opinion, and then I sort of caught like a 2 or 3 minute video clip of someone saying something that was against what I thought, and they made sense, and I remember thinking, well, that makes sense. I look into that. And I've not looked into it since. So this could be it. You could see. You might even if I'm sitting close enough to the mic, you might hear my mind cracking.
Yeah. We all need to prepare, as Barry possibly, you know, we could document his opinion changing right now and him being wrong.
Sorry for interrupting, but please go on.
No, and I'm at a similar level as well. I have no opinions about GMO. So if you want to inform me in any way so I can have like a basis for an opinion.
So a genetically modified organism, like I said, a good example is that, say, for instance, you want to use the bug killer called Roundup, which is you spray it and stuff dies, or the weed killer called Roundup. And Roundup is, I mean, the general basis, I forget what the actual chemical is that anything that is green, essentially, that you spray Roundup on, it dies. That's kind of what it is.
Attacks the chlorophyll.
And so, yeah, so thank you, chemist.
No problem. my only input.
So it would be advantageous if you have, say, a crop of, I don't know, corn or wheat or whatever. And it would be advantageous if you could spray Roundup on that plant, and that the plant that you're growing doesn't die, but the weeds around it do. Mm-hmm. But you normally can't do that because it'll kill the plant too. So an example of a genetically modified organism, and they've done this, I believe, would be a crop like corn or whatever they use, where they can genetically engineer it to be resistant to Roundup so that the crop doesn't die. You can just spray your field with this weed killer and all the weeds die and your crop doesn't, and you save lots of money.
Sounds good so far.
Yeah, so that's an example of a GMO. And so, you know, my opinion is what was previously sort of that, you know, this sounds like an awesome thing, going in and, you know, fiddling with the genes of plants to make them do what we want them to do agriculturally. And I kind of dismissed arguments against it as usually the same type of arguments where people say, irradiating food is bad because it's radiation, and radiation is scary.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
While there might be legitimate arguments against radiating food, I don't know enough about it to really, like, debate that. That's kind of what I was equivocating at that too is sort of just an argument for ignorance, because genetics is scary and we don't know much about it.
Yeah.
And so I recently heard an interesting debate about GMOs, where the people who were debating against GMOs brought in a lot of economic arguments, as far as, you know, we're spending billions of dollars on this GMO research, and so far we've only seen, you know, a handful of real applications, and mm-hmm. you know, the GMOs that were modified to be resistant to, I think they actually used Roundup specifically as an example, that's why I know about it. What they've seen is that they're now getting weeds that, due to natural selection, are becoming resistant as well to the Roundup, because we know we're using it so much more, and, you know, things like that. And so in that sense, my opinion was changed about GMOs. I'm not against GMOs now, but I now understand that there might be legitimate arguments.
Yeah, you
it's a bit more of a complex issue.
Mm-hmm. Sort of open view of it, and yeah. you think it could, your mind is sort of, yeah. Okay, so my mind didn't crack. But
your
I think
mind didn't crack.
My mind, I think now we're on, I don't remember the specifics of the examples I got told, but I'm on the same level now. Yeah. I was like just completely for them, and then someone mm-hmm. highlighted something, and I kind of thought, it was another economic argument, and I kind of thought, oh, okay, that I should look more into that. I mm-hmm. haven't, but yeah. I will at some point. So yeah, okay, we're on the same page there.
I think that's like the real fun thing about being a scientist, is constantly knowing less than you thought you did.
Oh no, it's terrifying. It's terrifying. It's not a fun thing at all.
The experience of the scientist is to constantly find out how stupid you really are with mm-hmm. ever-increasing accuracy.
But that's also interesting. Like, we, as scientists or as people who are at university, we all have access to journals. Like, so you study the arts, Gabby. I could probably get my hands on arts journals because I have access to them because I'm at university. But what, I mean, nobody has access to journals if they're not at university. And I know we're sort of starting
to
move open access.
Would you be able to understand them if they're written?
Well, exactly. I mean, that's a big debate people are having just now. I mean, there's the move to open access, which a lot of people are really happy about, myself included, and because it is publicly funded research and they think the public should have access to it. But the other argument is, okay, given the public access to it is all well and good, but if it's written in scientific jargon, you know, it may as well be written in a foreign language to them. So there's another argument of trying to change the way we write our science, we document our science, and that we do our publications. It's interesting.
I think every article should have some sort of summary or something like that.
That's readable by the public.
Yes, yeah. And it should be readable by the public, because I read some summaries that even I'm reading five times to mm-hmm. understand, which is definitely not a good example, you know, to summarize something that you actually need to clarify.
I mean, which is fine when you're a PhD student or you're an undergrad student and your job is to read these kind of things until you understand it. But if you're not, you know, you're going to look at it once and go, don't know what that says, mm-hmm. leave it. And a lot of the research is going to go by people, I think.
Yeah. If at least these sort of summaries or sort of short bits in non-complicated language could be public, mm-hmm. that would help public opinion about issues like climate change or vaccination or GMOs. So that would be brilliant.
And that's where lovely science communicators like us come in.
Yeah, there we go.
That's our job. Nice wee plug for us there. That's good.
So I think the last point that I had in mind on this topic was everybody has an opinion on things, mm-hmm. right? And I kind of see that as a bit of a fault, because I feel like in modern society, or just in society in general, I don't know, maybe the Romans did this too. Maybe they were kind of... I don't know if I can say douchebags on this. I might have to edit that out.
Maybe. We'll
but maybe they were as much of douchebags as we are. I don't know. But I feel like if somebody kind of confronts you and is like, what's your opinion on so-and-so or whatever, it's looked down upon to not have an opinion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Almost. Or it's when you say, I don't really have an opinion, it's often, you know, seen as an invitation to like say, oh, I don't know anything. Mm-hmm. Let me take your opinion. You'll convince me. But, you know, it's okay to try and convince somebody, but the thing is that I think that people need to be a little bit more comfortable with saying, I don't know, mm-hmm. and not having an opinion.
Yeah.
If you don't have enough evidence or you haven't done the research, you don't feel comfortable having done enough research, then you shouldn't necessarily have an opinion. Mm-hmm. And that's an okay response. It's an okay response to say to somebody, I need to look into it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was actually getting really annoyed because I was having a conversation with somebody recently and they brought up something. I forget what it was. I think they were saying like some media outlet was terrible or something. And I said, oh, yeah, you know, I need to look into that. And they were getting really annoyed with me because they're like, no, 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 this isn't my opinion. This is a fact. This is a crappy media outlet. And I was like, oh, okay, well, you know, I'm not entirely sure about that because I haven't looked into it. Mm-hmm. But thank you. And so I think that's the kind of response that people should be a little bit more willing to have when they don't, when they actually don't know.
Because the problem is they then keep a hold of that. They keep a hold of that fear of saying, I don't know. And then when people get into positions, and particularly when it comes to the media or when it comes to politics or when it comes to legislation, any of these kind of things, people are too afraid to say, I don't know. And they end up saying something wrong or ignorant or, you know, that they haven't researched properly. And then that's how things can start to snowball for there. I think, I like that. I think, people need to learn to say, I don't know.
And I think on the other side of that as well, a lot of people, when they don't have an opinion, force you to give them your own to them. Like, they can be the example of someone saying, you know a lot about this field, I know nothing about this field, please tell me everything you know, so that I can have my own opinions. And where I think the best way to be skeptical and the best way to be curious is to find out your own information before going to discuss it with someone.
Because if somebody gives you an opinion, like gives you an information, already opinionated information, so it's rather to do your own.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the thing is, the best thing you can do in that, if someone asks you, you know, and you know that they're looking for you to give you an, to give them an opinion, is to guide them to some kind of sources, I suppose. But then again,
of course,
it's all because that's your opinionated sources. It's the sources that you trust, so you're likely to come up with the same conclusions.
I feel like I'm a bad person when it comes to that, because I feel like when someone comes up to me and they say something like, Josh, because I study, you know, biology, and I've done a bit of reading and stuff with intelligent design and irreducible complexity. So when someone comes up to me and they're like, tell me about irreducible complexity, your evolution, I kind of have that response. It's like, well, you know, sit down for a minute.
Of course, it's always fun to communicate your own opinions. I'm not saying that that's the wrong thing to do.
There's a line of like forcing your opinion. Yeah.
It's hard to resist. Yeah. It's hard, especially when it's something you know about, and it's like, you know you're going to sound smart and you know it's something you like, so you like to talk about it. And it's probably something, if you're so excited to talk about it, it's probably something you've researched well.
It's probably relatively
safe that you're
doing.
But you can only hope.
I mean, that's also what we're doing right now as science communicators. We are saying what our opinions on a specific field are in every podcast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we do encourage people to go and do their own research on what we do talk about. But of course, they can might start off from what we have said.
Yeah, well, it's at least a starting point. If we get people discussing this on the website or something, or just through, there's so many ways now of getting your opinion out and chatting to people. There's Facebook, and we've got, you know, Twitter, and we have our own. Everything has a comments thread attached to it nowadays. Mm-hmm. So there's so many ways of getting, I'm bad for it when it comes to comments threads. I don't go anywhere near them. Mm-hmm. If it's Twitter, maybe I will, but comments threads, I won't go anywhere.
I think what I need to start doing is I start needing to like troll the comments.
No.
To like provoke people into being like, no, you know, that's stupid. So I'll just go on and like start posting things, you know, like, evolution is wrong. You know, that Vicky person doesn't know what she's talking about. We hate her. Just like post, I'm sorry, Vicky. you kind of looked down when I said that. I'm just like, oh. I'm not actually going to do that. Don't worry.
Now you know if it happens.
Who it is.
Or one of these other people can do it and you'll think it was me. It was really one of them.
Josh. But yeah, I mean, things like this, should always be instead of going to some sort of outlet like us or like any other science podcasts or magazines or anything, it should be a starting point for a conversation rather than taking it as gospel almost.
Yeah, and if you are curious about something, go find out about it. You know, don't sit there wondering what the answers are. Do research it, especially if you do have access to journals or media. that's obviously
or
the
podcast.
Best or podcast.
I think that's a good thing actually. You mean with us especially, I mean, okay, we are relatively small, but even nowadays the world is just getting smaller, so even the relatively big thing, if you have a newspaper that you like or a news organization, they've all got all their journalists and all their researchers all have Twitter accounts. You can ask anybody anything. It's becoming a lot less scary. You don't see these people as these, you know, high above telling you the lay of the land. You're kind of, you can ask them a question like that in 140 characters or less.
Yeah, so go ask all of your questions that you've ever had on Twitter.
Yeah. Okay, well, thanks very much. Thanks, Gabby and Josh, for coming in and chatting with us. We'll hopefully get some more chat on the website from this. We'll maybe try and start some conversations, and I think we've mentioned a good few things that that'll get some people talking. So
see, we can guilt trip people now into posting on the website, because if you don't post, we're going to feel so lonely, like, you know.
And now you've heard
no friends.
You've heard their voices, so they're real people.
Yeah.
These are real people you're disappointing by not chatting to us on
online. It's really
sad. And challenge our opinions, be skeptical of what we have to say.
Yes, please do. So, yeah, thanks very much for coming in, guys.
All right.
We'll see you all later, and hopefully we'll get some chat from you online. For now, Jisters, that's all for this podcast episode, and we hope you enjoyed it. If you want to know more about Dr. Watt's research, check out the links on our website, and as a bonus, you can meet the team and get some hands-on experience of their work and learn about the history of parapsychology at their upcoming workshop, The Science of the Paranormal, at this year's Edinburgh Fringe. It sounds like a lot of fun. Until next time... Is that about Sesame Street? That sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah, I feel, yeah.